Thanks. I'm going to, I'm afraid, talk about reionization. I heard there was a full session devoted to this subject on the first day of the conference, but I hope I can say a couple of new points about it. And so the focus of this talk will actually be twofold. One is to present an observational summary where there will probably overlap with previous talks on trying to convince you reionization history seems to be extended and complex if you believe WMAP data and some aspects of the Sloan quasars. And then I want to talk more about how this might be achieved in the more physical models of reionization. And I hope to get some time to talk about the future of the subject. Just to go extremely quickly, as you all have heard, the WMAP result measured an opacity, which is roughly four times higher. The mean value is roughly 0.17, which is four times higher than the fully ionized universe opacity if the universe is fully ionized to redshift 6 and neutral beyond. I'm not going to talk more about that. We'll hopefully have WMAP results soon for the next set of data. And then the neutral hydrogen is probed by the high redshift quasars, and there I'm also sure most of you appreciate by now the problem, which is that if the universe was fully neutral, it would be so opaque that it would saturate completely the absorption. And so if you just directly use the fact that in the highest redshift quasars there is no flux, you get a relatively weak limit on lower limit on the neutral fraction, which is not nowhere near unity. It's more like 10⁻³. And so the first thing I wanted to do is convince you that despite this, so I'm going to just be talking about the neutral hydrogen and the Sloan quasars and try to convince you that there is actually evidence that the universe is becoming quite neutral around redshift of 6, and in particular that we're seeing the overlap or percolation of discrete ionized bubbles around ionizing sources. And so I have three arguments here. I will emphasize this one since this session is about the IGM, which has to do with the temperature of the IGM. So usually this is a less commonly used probe of reionization, but the thermal state of the intergalactic medium contains a history, information about the history of how it was ionized and heated. And in particular, it's measured, the temperature is measured from absorption lines around redshift 4 to be quite warm, around 20,000 degrees. I'll argue in a second that it's too cold in a simple model where you had a very early ionization and nothing else afterwards. Now, this argument I think you're probably most familiar with is the fact that even though the strict lower limit on the neutral fraction is quite weak, there is still a sharp rise with redshift of the inferred opacity, which seems to be a sharper rise than you would obtain from just the evolution of ionizing sources from the model diagram. There's nearly an order of magnitude jump in neutral fraction around redshift 5.5 and 6. And then finally, I'll talk about detection, which we claim in one of the Sloan quasars of the actual boundary of the Sturmgen sphere, which can be used to infer the universe is quite neutral. So the IGM temperature, it's basically, this is a paper we had with Lam Hui after the WMAP results came out. And basically, the temperature of the IGM, if you just think of the mean density, a fluid element at mean density, is determined by photoionization heating, mostly from the ionizing sources, which heat the gas, which is balanced by adiabatic cooling. And what happens is the first ionization, when the neutral fraction of hydrogen or helium changes by a large factor, gives a large heating input to the IGM, and then you only have a residual, if it stays highly ionized, you have only a trickle rate of heating afterwards from the ionization of the small amount of hydrogen or helium left. And so the IGM, if you have a single ionization episode, which raises the just completely ionized the universe, and stays highly ionized afterwards, universe tends to forget its history prior to redshift 10, by a redshift of 4, it won't remember what happened before redshift 10. And so it has only memory of the events which occurred after redshift of 10, and which is basically the argument of why you need to have something happening at lower redshift. And so the value which we used in this paper is that at redshift of 3.9, actually, the temperature of the IGM is about 20,000 degrees. And then we made some illustrative models of how the temperature would evolve if you had various ionization histories. And so in this top panel, we assume very simple models where hydrogen and helium are together ionized suddenly at some high redshift, here around 15. So in the red curve, we assume it stays ionized afterwards, and it reaches this asymptote, which by redshift 4 is too cold relative to these data points. In another model, we assumed that the ionizing sources, again, give this initial temperature jump, but then the universe is allowed to recombine as the ionizing sources would turn off, so it would be cold again. And then there's a second episode of ionization around redshift 7, and then you actually can match this high temperature. And so the bottom panel is the same exercise, but assuming that helium is only singly ionized together with the hydrogen at this redshift. So these two curves, C and D, are the same. You basically have the same conclusion if you do it around redshift of here 12, and you let the universe stay ionized, highly ionized afterwards, it becomes too cold by this redshift 4. Unless you have a second ionization on redshift 7 or so. And so basically the fact that the IGM is so hot implies, roughly speaking, of order unity change in the abundance of either hydrogen or helium must be occurring later than redshift 10. The biggest caveat to this argument, I think, is that we know it's seems to be that helium is actually getting its second ionization around redshift of 3 or 4. And one question is if the known population of quasars, of bright quasars, might be driving this helium ionization and then heating the IGM up to this temperature of 20,000 degrees already at redshift 4. Then the known quasars can account for this heating, and you don't have any constraint on previous reionization. And so I think it would be great to push these. And it's not clear, I think, from the present data, if you take the known quasars, whether they can account for this heating by as early as redshift 4. And if it would be great to obtain temperatures at just slightly higher redshifts, where we really have only a few quasars, and see if the IGM is still hot at those redshifts. Another interesting point is all these calculations were just basically illustrative toy models where the temperature was computed at the mean density of the IGM. Now, in principle, you can do much better. There's more information in the temperature. For instance, this plot shows the temperature distribution still only at the mean density, but actually taking a model for a reionization history as a function of redshift, so each fluid element gets ionized at a different redshift based on how the filling factor of ionized bubbles evolve. And this finite spread, I'll show you this kind of model in a second, but the finite spread in reionization redshifts for the distribution of fluid elements gives a spread of temperatures. So for instance, at 4, 3, and 2.4, you see a red one is at the temperature distribution around the redshift of 4, and there's actually cold pockets which have not been ionized, and there's a big scatter, and as time goes on, this distribution tends to narrow. And so this should be actually convolved with temperature distribution, which comes from density distributions, not just at the mean density. But in principle, there's definite prediction that the temperature should have a scatter which is large following reionization epoch, and then it gets smaller and smaller. So you could try to dig more out of the data, I think. Now, the second argument, probably was already mentioned, is basically the fact that if you take the Sloan quasars, then from quasar to quasar, you can obtain for each one an ionizing background rate, and it seems to drop rapidly around redshift 6. And this strong drop was actually not easy to explain in models where you use the galaxies as they evolve due to the model diagram, but it's actually quite a natural prediction. This is actually a very old, by now, simulation by Razumov et al. I just copied it here so that you can see. At the epoch of percolation of ionized regions, there is a very steep drop in the Gaunt-Peterson opacity, and otherwise the evolution is quite smooth. And so this is the other. So the argument is that we're seeing this sharp drop around redshift 6. Okay, now if you didn't like these two arguments, then I'll show you a third one, which I think is actually, to me, the most convincing one. And this comes from looking at the spectrum of one of the Sloan quasars. This is the redshift 6.28 quasar. And this is the spectrum of the quasar in Lyman alpha and Lyman beta aligned in redshift. And so the quasar is at 6.28. So the Lyman alpha line center is here. And it's been known immediately that there is a large ionized region. The Gaunt-Peterson trough doesn't start until redshift 6.2 or so. There's flux transmission over this delta z of 0.08, and then you lose the flux in alpha. Now, if you look at the beta, it turns out you lose the beta flux almost exactly at the same redshift. The basic argument in simple sentence is that you lose the flux very rapidly over a narrow range in redshifts or narrow range in radius as you come away from the source. The opacity builds up quite rapidly. The beta flux is easier to lose than the alpha flux because the beta cross-section is smaller. So this jump is actually quite large in terms of the buildup of the opacity.
But now, like a
sorry?
It can be delayed. Is this a huge
Below actually, it doesn't matter for some of the argument, but I just took the data. Let me go on because it will be clear what I'm assuming. This is actually a blow-up of the data. This is in alpha. This is in beta. These are flux detections with error bars. This is 6.2. And I divided it into three regions. There's a region here where there's flux transmitted. And actually, the 6.28 is out here. So we're talking about a shell, which is about 6 megaparsec from the quasar. And each shell is about each region here is about a megaparsec thick. And there's transmission here and here in alpha and beta. In this second region, there is no transmission in alpha. There's still some in Lyman beta. In the last region, you lose the flux alpha and beta. And so the quoted limits from the papers is that to lose the flux in alpha, you need an optical depth in Lyman alpha of about 6 or more. To lose the flux in the Lyman beta part of the spectrum, you need a factor of about 3 higher opacity, maybe 20 or so. And therefore, the statement you can read off from these two diagrams is that as you go further and further from this quasar, the optical depth is about 6 or smaller here, and then it jumps to about 20 or higher here. Now, why does that mean anything interesting? Well, because if you compute what is the opacity as a function of wavelength or redshift, there are two contributions. This quasar is surrounded by an H2 region, and there's the Gaunt-Peterson optical depth outside it, which protrudes into the wavelengths near the source because of the damping wing, and it's a smooth contribution. And then inside the Strömgren sphere, you still have some residual hydrogen in ionization equilibrium with the quasar, which is this bumpy curve. And on the average, this residual neutral fraction inside the bubble builds up optical depth because the flux drops from the quasar as 1 over r squared. So on average, this opacity can only build up roughly as r squared. But we're talking on the mean, but we're talking only about a small fractional distance change. So this opacity actually cannot build up very rapidly. On the other hand, if you have the Gaunt-Peterson damping wing, you can, of course, have a very big jump in opacity over a narrow range. And so we just basically took a simulation box, which was kindly provided by Renyu Chen, and assumed three parameters: the size of the H2 region, the neutral fraction outside, which is equivalent to some smooth background flux, and then the ionizing luminosity of this source. And so this then gives us the map of the H neutral hydrogen everywhere. and we can compute what fraction of line of sights have the property which I take from the data, is that the opacity here should be below 6, here should be above 20, here is between 6 and 20. And so it turns out this gives a constraint on all three parameters. And this is basically the percent of line of sights in the simulation box which satisfy this criteria. And this is only as a function of neutral fraction outside and size of the Sturmian sphere. And there's basically a big peak around the neutral universe, which gives this sharp jump. And the size, so this we claim is restricted in the range of 20% to unity. The actual size of the Sturmian sphere is measured also quite accurately to within 10% from the location of this sharp jump. And even the ionizing flux of the quasar can be constrained due to the mean opacity in region 1 near the quasar. And so, therefore, this actually implies that the universe is what? Neutral fraction of 20% or higher. Now, the size actually can be converted to neutral fraction. I think Avi talked about this on Monday. This size is actually large, but it's still should be much larger if this quasar at its observed luminosity lived for 10 to the 7 years or more. So this actually also implies the fact that this Sturmian sphere is not much larger, that the neutral fraction has to be quite high, 10% or higher. So this really is two independent arguments from the Sturmian sphere for neutral fractions which are of order 10% or larger. One other thing I should emphasize is that this data also gives a relatively sharp surface for this ionization front, which has to be a megaparsec or less. Otherwise, it would spread out the buildup of tau over more than a megaparsec. And this implies a constraint on the spectrum of this quasar as well. It cannot be too hard so that you make the mean free path of photons larger than about a megaparsec. So the mean ionizing photon energy of this quasar should be less than about 0.2 keV. That's interesting, I think, mostly in the context of trying to do X-ray reionization by obscure quasars. This object is presumably not one which is ionizing mostly by X-rays. Okay, so these three arguments, I think, mean the universe is quite neutral. I think I should mention a more recent argument, which actually puts an upper limit, potentially, on the neutral fraction. This comes from the abundance of Lyman alpha-emitting galaxies, which I believe was also mentioned on the first day of this conference. Now, I'll try to get into this towards the end of my talk, how this is modeled, but there is a very simple point, which is that if you have Lyman alpha-emitting galaxies, then depending on how neutral the universe is, the Lyman alpha flux of the galaxy will be suppressed. Now, this also depends on how big an ionized sphere each Lyman alpha emitting galaxy can evacuate, which then reduces this suppression. But what I did, just for illustration here, I took a very simple model, uniformly clumped IgM with a log normal density with clumping of 10. I put a source which lived for 10 to 8 years, has escape fraction of 100% of its ionizing photons, and a relatively large line width. And so these basically are conservative assumptions in the sense that these make large ionized bubbles. And then in this universe, you can compute the attenuation of the total line flux. I assume the Gaussian line shape with this width. And as you go to brighter and brighter sources, you attenuate the flux less. So this is in a neutral universe. The flux is attenuated by a factor of 10 or higher for this 10 to the 41 ergs per second line luminosities. Goes down to about a factor of between 2 and 3 for very bright galaxies. In a ionized universe where the neutral fraction is 10%, the suppression factor is reduced to basically below a factor of 2 everywhere. Now, why is this interesting? because there is some preliminary data which allows us to construct the luminosity functions of Lyman alpha emitters, which I just copied from a recent compilation by Malhotra and Rhodes. And this curve here, this dashed curve, is the luminosity function, best fit luminosity function of Lyman alpha emitters at redshift 5.7, as determined from, I think, of order 30 sources. And then these points with error bars are the compilation of the redshift 6.5 luminosity function, which essentially, roughly speaking, there's no evolution. There seems to be as many Lyman alpha emitting galaxies as there were at redshift 5.7. And now if you assume that there weren't intrinsically more galaxies, Lyman alpha emitting galaxies, earlier, then this means you can't really tolerate losing any of the flux of these galaxies, otherwise you'd reduce the luminosity function. And so I show here the predicted luminosity function. If you start from the at redshift 6.5, you assume you have the same luminosity function as you have at redshift 5.7, and then you have varying fully ionized, fully neutral, or 10% neutral IgM, you can actually plot very easily the luminosity function. It turns out the suppression is much smaller here at the bright end, but the luminosity function is fainter. So it's almost like just a vertical reduction of the abundance of emitters everywhere. And you basically find that if you have the universe quite neutral, it becomes inconsistent with this data, which is actually a point already made by in this paper. But I think it's important to emphasize that you can't really put a much better constraint than that. So I just plotted here as a function of neutral fraction the formal probability of, you know, this is just taking this luminosity function, assigning a probability to each case as a function of neutral fraction given these 6.5 data. And the probability becomes of order 10% if the universe is completely ionized, which is the acceptance criterion basically for the luminosity functions being the same at 5.7 and 6.5. And then the probability drops quite rapidly when you approach a neutral universe, but it's very difficult to rule out. Basically, these H2 regions save the line flux, so it's very difficult to rule out ionization, which is so strong that the neutral fraction is below of order 20% or so, or 30%. So this does imply there seems to be some ionization, but not so strong as to conflict with this 10% fiducial value. And I think the upshot is that if you piece together the history of ionization, is it sounds likely that there is the percolation epoch around redshift 6, and we're seeing this epoch when it's about 10%, the neutral fraction, dropping down to much smaller values. And then WMAP, of course, implies there's some significant ionization, if you believe the 17% number for the optical depth earlier. And so in the remaining time, I'm not sure how many minutes, I want to talk about how this might be achieved by the sources in the universe, this kind of evolution of the mean neutral fraction. Now, what this implies, I think, at face value is that you have the percolation epoch of ionizing bubbles here, so there must be something else causing significant ionization here, but not enough to achieve a percolation earlier because you would have used up that percolation. And so the question is, why is there this initial ionization versus this percolation? And that, very broadly speaking, to me suggests some feedback process, which means something starts to ionize the universe, but then stops or partially stops, and then lets other sources achieve this percolation or redshift 6. Now, what could this feedback be? It would be quite nice to associate this in the context of cold dark matter structure formation, to associate these different populations with larger and larger halos which form in the universe. And there are some characteristic halo masses which correspond to various physical effects. One is that the smallest halos which you can form and form any ionizing source is roughly fiducial mass here, is a 10 to the 4 solar mass halo, which is above the cosmological genes mass. Now, if you want to cool the gas in the halo and you can, and you think there are hydrogen molecules present, then at 10 to the 5 solar mass, you can use the hydrogen molecules and cool the gas and potentially form ionizing sources. If you think the molecules are not there, for reasons I hope to get to, then you have to wait longer, and the mass scale is much larger, where you can use atomic cooling to cool the gas. Now, finally, a more subtle point is, if you're going to ionize the whole universe, it's clear that to complete the job, you eventually have to form, in most cases, you think you have to form ionizing sources in parts of the universe which are already ionized to complete full ionization. And so, in fact, it could be as inferred from dwarf galaxy formation in the local universe, is that that the scale of a halo which can form, which can collect the gas in its potential well, even in the face of already photoheated gas, is higher by another roughly 2 orders of magnitude. Now, can this physics actually explain the complicated ionization history? Let me not go through this. I think basically the point is you could, in the first halos, either form metal-free stars or you could form seed black holes, both of which are quite efficient ionizers of hydrogen and also potentially of helium. Now, I think we can quickly rule out the fact that this percolation at redshift 6 is being done by black holes. And this might be a bit like killing a dead horse, but because certainly if you count the bright known quasar population, it drops rapidly and you don't get enough ionizing photons to ionize the hydrogen. But there's always the worry, of course, that there could be fainter quasars, which we don't see in optical surveys, you know, small dwarf galaxies, which at their center have 10 to the 5 solar mass black holes. And if there are a lot of them, they can not be seen in optical surveys or even X-ray surveys and can actually produce a lot of ionizing radiation. But in this paper, we basically point out that you would if you try to produce about 10 ionizing photons per hydrogen atom by black hole accretion, you would produce inevitably some X-ray radiation, and you would overpredict the soft X-ray background. If you try to explain this redshift 6 percolation with black holes, I should just emphasize there. I'll come to the second question of whether the early reionization can be done by black holes, for which the answer is that it's still allowed. It's only the redshift 6 percolation that I think is quite convincingly ruled out, even by hidden black holes. And so the conventional picture, I think, should be that the normal galaxies, which are there at redshift 6, can account for this percolation at redshift 6. And in fact, you can start from the dark matter halos, and with very reasonable numbers, you can account for enough ionizing photons. And in observations, it's also recently been argued that there are enough galaxies observed to do this. But you can start from the halos and just make some very simple assumptions. Like you take a normal Salpeter population of stars, you turn 20% of the gas into the stars, 10% of ionizing radiation escapes, and the clumping factor which drives the recombination is 10 or so. It's only the combination of these factors which matter if you populate all halos with these galaxies. And the other number not listed here is the smallest mass halo. I assumed here you have to wait for 10 to the 8 solar mass halos, which cool by atomic cooling. And then you just get an evolution of the ionized volume fraction from high redshift to low. This combination of 8 is basically quite reasonable numbers. They aren't certain, but this combination has to be about 8 or so to have the percolation occur around redshift 6. Now, immediately, you can find the optical depth under this curve from electron scattering is about 0.08, so you already doubled the optical depth of 0.04, which is out to redshift 6, just from the tail of these halos, with just this naive model, but you're still a factor of too short of the W value of 0.17. Now, clearly, if you want to go up to 0.17, you have to have higher efficiency at higher redshift, but you cannot have higher efficiency here at redshift of 6, otherwise you percolate too early. So there must be an evolution of this epsilon at high redshifts, which is higher than 8. And these at least three ideas, which I'm not sure will work, but at least they're attractive, concrete physical pictures. One idea is that you do have a population of very early objects, so you lower the mass threshold for halos in which you form objects because there are molecules present which can form sufficient number of ionizing sources with these molecules before the molecules are dissociated, that they can raise the optical depth to about double this 0.08. I think the main problem with this is that molecules are quite fragile, and that's been known for a while, that 12 eV photons can easily wipe out molecules in the rest of the universe. Another problem, which is a more recent paper with Peng Oh, is that if you take a small halo which produces ionizing radiation and makes an H2 region, after the source dies, if this is a massive star, after a million years the source dies, and the H2 region left as a fossil, it will recombine, but it will contain the extra entropy. It will not cool back to the very cold initial IGM temperature. It will cool at most to a few hundred Kelvin because of Compton scattering of CMB. And you can't dump away more of the entropy than the one you do by Compton scattering to the CMB. And so the residual entropy prevents the contraction of this gas to high densities. And because the gas remains more tenuous, it's easier actually to wipe out the molecules. So that's a problem with this scenario. Now the other option, which I think was also quite attractive, at least physically, is that you don't rely on these molecules, but instead what could happen is that there are 10 to the 8 solar mass halos which form ionizing bubbles, but inside these ionized bubbles, they raise essentially the scale. You could think of it as raising the genes mass in these ionized bubbles to a factor of 10 or 100 larger, because the source which has to form there has to collect the gas in the face of ionizing background. And so it's only, so you have to, this is a quite different feedback. It's sort of asymptotic behavior where you can use fewer sources in the ionized bubbles. You can use all the sources down to the lower mass outside the ionized bubbles, but it will slowly asymptote to full ionization at redshift 6. The problem with this method is that we had a paper with Mark Dijkstra where we showed that it's very difficult actually to prevent, unlike in the local universe where you can prevent the gas from falling into shallow potentials down to about 10 to 50 kilometers per second, the gas is prevented from falling in because of the photoheating. At higher redshift, it doesn't work as efficiently because the gas cools faster, because the ionizing background is probably lower, and because halos can even self-shield. Even these small halos can actually self-shield at higher redshifts because the densities are higher. So we think this feedback doesn't actually probably operate around redshift 6 and higher. Finally, you could have a high efficiency early on if you had a POP3 population where the metal-free stars are more efficient ionizers than the normal stars. And in this scenario, it would work if you assume that there's a sudden transition at some redshift from the metal-free to the normal stellar population, which to me is unclear if you can actually produce such an abrupt transition. I think it's more likely for the metal pollution to be local near the sources. And so this POP2, POP3 transition will be localized around the existing sources. And it's not clear you can get enough contribution from the POP3 objects to explain that all the way to 0.17. Now, if you forget these worries, at least one good thing is, which I don't think I'll get to, but these predict very different shapes for the evolution of the ionizing fraction. If you use the H2 cooling in the small initial halos, what you expect is you start ionizing the universe, and then at some point you wipe out the molecules, and then there is a stall, and then you continue ionizing the universe. The efficiency has to be only boosted overall by a factor of 2 in these early halos, because you actually have, you postulated the existence of many more sources. So there has to be no big boost in efficiency. It's just the molecules have to be preserved. And there will be no double ionization in this case, because the you can't have a double peak, because the molecules would reform if you recombine the universe and there was no ionizing background. So there's more like a steady state here where the molecules are kept at some level. So this is a characteristic shape for this curve. And if you use the second idea where you photoheat and prevent formation of objects in ionized regions, you will have to have a slow asymptote and basically wait till these largest halos, 50 kilometers per second or larger, would become typical and they finish the job. If you had a sudden pop 2, pop 3 transition, you can have a principle in the very abrupt transition assumption, a curve which looks like that. And I won't have time to discuss, but these two curves are actually distinguishable by their future CMB measurements, which don't just measure tau, one number, which is integrated column, but can measure at least some other parameters of the integral of this curve. Now, in the remaining 1 minute, let me mention what I think is quite attractive idea, is that if the Sloan black holes are there and as large as we think they are, then it's quite natural for their buildup to occur as a result of merging of pre-existing black holes and accretion of gas into these holes. And the X-rays emanating from these accreting black holes can partially ionize the IGM. And so this is more like a distinct population, not a feedback per se, which I was promoting so far. And these sources could sort of half ionize the universe until the regular galaxies form, which complete the job. You can actually produce X-rays with decaying particles, which I quite like this model. When we originally proposed after WMAP, is some particle which essentially decays to very relativistic electrons, which upscatter CMB photons, and you basically get, from this scenario, an X-ray background. And if you fine-tune this X-ray background, the X-ray photon energies, then I think you can probably still have such a model, but it's more esoteric. I think these black hole seeds are quite attractive, and we would then naturally have to model the evolution of the seed black hole population. And let me skip this topic. Basically, if you take the known merger trees from dark matter histories, you populate them quite reasonably with seed black holes, you can actually produce the required number of ionizing photons. Let me just instead mention, this is my last slide, just to eliminate a caveat from this picture. An assumption of all these arguments is that the Sloan black holes indeed are very massive because of essentially their very bright luminosities. And one caveat to this has always been is if the Sloan quasars are strongly magnified by gravitational lensing, and maybe they don't have billion solar mass black holes, instead they have, let's say, if it's magnified by a factor of 10, then just 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes, which would have big impact on these merger trees in this context. And in fact, we think we can rule this out, that the Sloan quasars are highly magnified. The issue being is that if you take simple lens models, you can produce high magnification, but almost all the time you produce a second image. And no such second image is seen on HST images of the four highest redshift quasars at HST resolution of 0.3 arc seconds. And we try to see if you could still, in this recent paper by Chuck Keaton and Mike Coulin, we try to see if you allow yourself bigger freedom in the lens models, assuming lenses can be elliptic or have shear, then you can actually produce high magnification with just a single image, or you can produce high magnification with a large flux ratio of images so that the second image is not actually detected in Sloan. And we just took basically a realistic distribution of ellipticities and shears and the population of dark matter halos with profiles, which are either NFW or singular isothermal sphere. And so this population of dark halos averaged over these shear and ellipticities, at most we find give of order 20% probability. So it's not actually a tiny probability. You can actually have sources on an overall a 20% chance, say at most, for producing a magnification by a factor of 10 for the Sloan quasars. But since we have at least four which don't show a second image, it's quite unlikely that all of them actually are faking us and they're all small black holes. So big black holes are their early redshifts. And so let me just put up my conclusions and thanks.
Zoltan, I have a comment concerning the temperature constraint on the realization redshift. I think that a possibility that Francesco Vignati, together with myself and Simon, has proposed is that structure formation between redshift 4 and 6 could produce hot gas, which is Bremsstrahlung emitting, and therefore producing, if I recall the number, something like 6 to 7 photons per helium atom in that redshift range. So that could provide maybe the extra flux that you were requiring from quasar that would come natural for this from this mechanism.
Yeah, I don't have actually. I think that's a caveat. I don't have a good argument against just the idea that you have extra heat input from these shocks. So it's probably going to come down then to looking at the more detailed temperature distributions, and they're probably different in the shock scenario than in the stochastic reionization scenario.
Right.
I agree.
We discussed the figures. A fair amount of variation in the line alpha and line beta absorption patterns between the various six places. Have you actually tried redoing the analysis in the other places yet?
I really haven't done the same analysis for the other quasars. I think the one feature which is important is this sharp transition that's present in all four quasars, which will give for all four quasars at least one of the two arguments, which is that they all seem to be all four seem to be surrounded by a Sturmian sphere whose size is roughly 6 megaparsec, as inferred from the sharp transition. Now, only for at least one of the quasars, I know we can't derive directly our spectroscopic limit on the neutral fraction because there's no intermediary region where there is Lyman beta flux, but there's no Lyman alpha flux, where we use the statistics to actually constrain the neutral fraction.
And I was saying probably I wasn't following Martin Schwarzschild advice by not presenting more than two ideas in paper. But probably it's obscure because all these three effects, that H2 cooling in particular, and the Fourier heating, and the jump in UV efficiency, were included in my model. I just want to point out that the clamping factor is actually evolving quite rapidly with time. So the epsilon itself kind of a little bit obscuring the actual effect.
I think that's fair. I just think the parameters are still quite uncertain. So that's why I prefer to look at it in the way they're you one effect dominates versus the other, and you look with Planck to see what constraints you can put on the curves. But yes, I know.
How can one actually observe these theoretical sources of ionization at redshifts of 15? And what are their signatures that one might look for, other than reionization?
So that's a half an hour talk. It's here on my computer, but maybe I give the most recent one, which maybe most people haven't seen. So with the JWST, we had actually a series of papers early on with the AVI where we predicted number of sources for JWST, and you can see a lot of them. I would focus on the more recent thing I've done, which is in actually radio. I know there were discussions of 21 centimeter, and so one thing I worked on most recently is to predict the number of quasars in the radio, and I think they can actually be seen in the radio. In fact, they might already be in the first survey. We just have to know how to find them. So basically, this is a model which is based on the dark halos, populates them with black holes, which accrete at Eddington luminosity with this scaling, which was first promoted by Silk and Rees from feedback between black hole and halo mass, roughly consistent with the M-sigma relation. And then White and Loeb actually showed it works quite well in optical and X-ray. And so we took the same model, and then we took the radial loudness distribution from the overlap sample of Sloan and First, and we predicted, therefore, the number of radial loud quasars, the function of redshift. What we found is, we found two interesting results, but the one you're asking about are the bright sources, which are, let's say, 10 millijansky or few millijansky, which would actually be useful, bright enough to potentially find the radio Gunn-Peterson effect. You need these bright sources. There could be, well, 4 to 10 per square degrees at this millijansky sensitivity of First. So I'm quite interested of how you pick those out. Presumably, parts of First would have to be correlated with very deep optical data. We can see in X-ray. In X-ray, there are actually constraints now, because you could see a 10 to the 8th solar mass black hole out to redshift 10 or so in the Chandra deep fields.
I think you have to be careful with those arguments about H2 regions, which some people still call Strongholm spheres incorrectly. They're not Strongholm spheres. But galaxies are correlated, and I mentioned that yesterday. And we know they're correlated, highly correlated on clusters at low redshift, so we also expect them to be highly clustered at high redshift. And so then those arguments about individual H2 regions are a little bit suspicious, because they are clustered and they're usually driven, H2 regions are driven by several galaxies, and we actually see a small one, whereas it's driven by the big one, which is obscured, and small one which sits behind the big one, which is not obscured. And so those are really complicated. The sizes of those H2 regions and their shapes are really complicated, and so it's not very easy to put constraints by simply assuming sort of round balls around individual galaxies.
Yes.
I think it's a mistake that Malhotra and Rhodes made in their claim. I don't think it's a very claim.
Well, first of all, I think for the individual quasars I talked about, that's actually conservative. If there were extra sources, all the constraints would be stronger. Now, for the Lyman alpha luminosity function prediction, I think it is important to statistically put in properly the suppression factors. And so, no slides. Well, I think the bottom line is, I just checked very quickly, if you boosted how much you would have to boost the ionizing rate beyond what I assumed, which I listed my assumptions for the single sphere around the galaxy, if you boost it by over 100 around each galaxy, the number of ionizing photons rate, then you would clear out enough this neutral hydrogen that you would be consistent with the luminosity function.
By the way, this
now, So I think your simulation, but I think there are two points. I think it's very good point that the clustering of sources can make bigger HT region and can increase the transmission of Lyman alpha. The reason you get anything strong, I think even afterwards potentially, is that the luminosity function data is coming in. It's very tentative, but it's coming in a way where the luminosity function doesn't evolve at all. So you really can't tolerate even very small suppression of the line flux. So you need to boost to very high ionizing rates, which I'm not sure is going to be achieved by clustering, but I agree it should be done.
Okay, I just want to reinforce this point in a very simple way, that when you take a single quasar with that kind of luminosity and that kind of lifetime, and you calculate the ionized sphere, which Nick is correct in pointing out is not the equilibrium Sturmgen sphere, it hasn't grown that large, you can add up the number of source halos in the same volume and ask for reasonable parameters what ionizing flux they contribute, and they will contribute as much as that quasar by the time the quasar has lived something of order 10 to the 7 years. And this is not even taking into account the bias. When they take account of the bias, it will be an even more important source.
It strengthens the argument.
What's that?
It strengthens the
argument. Well, I don't think it strengthens the argument if you can't, if you need to use the thickness of the transition, because the sources that you're talking about are no longer at the center, now they're spread throughout the volume, and I think it's a more complicated argument for the thickness of your transition. The other point I wanted to make is just a second kind of misconception that not perhaps the people doing the calculations don't have, but there's a general misconception. We often talk about the tremendous jump in efficiency for ionizing when we go from POP2 to POP3. But this is primarily a function of making the mass function top heavy. If you do the same thing for POP2 stars, which people have often speculated about, the POP2 stars will be within about a factor of 2 the same ionizing photon efficiency. According to one of the recent papers by this, the factor was 1.6.